Let's call this meeting the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 10:32 a.m. on Tuesday, May 3rd, 2016. Present we have Representative Wilson, Representative Guerra, Representative Kawasaki, Vice Chair Sadler, I'm Co-Chair Thompson, we have Co-Chair Newman, Representative Munoz, Representative Edgman, Representative Gaddis, and Representative Guttenberg. Please turn off all your cell phones. We don't want them going off during this, or you'll have to buy donuts. Okay, today we're going to hear from the Department of Departments concerning House Bill 251, the Electronic Tax Returns and Fisheries Tax by House Rules by request of the Governor. We have a CS for this bill. It's version E. Co-Chair?
Mr. Chair, I move we bring committee substitute for House Bill 251, Finance Version 29GH2921/EECHO before the committee for discussion purposes as our working document.
Seeing no objections, we'll be addressing the E version, the CS. Here to present a PowerPoint presentation on House Bill 251 and walk us through this sectional is the Department of Revenue Deputy Commissioner Jerry Burnett and Department of Fish and Game Deputy Commissioner Kevin Brooks. I'd also like to recognize we have Representative Ortiz in the audience, and we have Commissioner of Department of Revenue, Randy Hoffbeck. Thanks for being here. And Representative Tito's joined us. Okay, gentlemen, place yourselves on the record, and we'll see your slideshow.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, Jerry Burnett, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue.
Good morning. Kevin Brooks, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Fish and Game.
And during the presentation, please address your questions to a particular slide so we can get through the entire presentation. And after that, we'll address additional questions that might not have been answered. Continue, gentlemen.
So House Bill 251 is started as an act requiring the electronic submission of a tax return or report with the Department of Revenue relating to fisheries business tax, fisheries resource landing tax, relating to refunds to local governments, and providing for an effective date. The CS that you have before you removes the electronic submission portion of the bill because House Bill 375 passed both the House and the Senate, and so no longer needed in the context of this bill. Okay, so just a little overview of the fisheries business tax. It's paid by persons or businesses who process fish in Alaska or export fish from Alaska, and it's charged on the price for the raw resource or the fair market value. So it's based either on what they actually paid for the fish or the fair market value of the fish that they as they're purchased. We'll need a little more cord here. Okay. A little history on the tax. Started out as a territorial salmon pack tax in 1913. The tax base was expanded to include other fish between 1913 and 1949. Fish business license became required in 1951, and municipal sharing began in 1962, increased from 10% to 50% over the years. It's currently at 50%. The current tax structure began in 2004 with shore-based facility having 1% for developing fisheries and a 3% tax for established fisheries, floating facilities 3% for developing fisheries and 5% for established fisheries, salmon canneries at 4.5%, and direct marketing license holders pay the shore-based rates. So that'd be people who catch and sell the fish directly.
Representative Wilson, question while we're going here on this slide.
Can you tell me, and some of this could be really basic for some of us who, you know, live in the interior. Can you tell me the difference?
Pull your mic a little closer, please. Thank you.
Can you tell me the difference between a shore-based facility and a floating facility, what they do? Or is it just a difference of one's on land and one's not?
Through the chair, Kevin Brooks, Deputy Commissioner. Yes, that really is the basic difference. You have floaters. They're usually large processors. They may head and gut fish. You might think of a pollock fishery out in the Gulf. And they freeze large cubes of product. and shore-based is just what it says. Typically have more local hire, maybe some folks on the property taxes for their facilities, things like that. So some, those are some of the basic differences.
Perfect. Thank you.
Representative Pruitt's joined us. Co-Chair Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, on that point. Welcome, Mr. Burnett. Does it matter if they're beyond the three-mile limit as far as taxes go within Alaska and how the ability for the state of Alaska to tax them?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, no, it doesn't. They're taxed. If they're beyond 3 miles, they're still taxed in Alaska. And actually, with Pollock, we're going to get to that later in the presentation, but under the Magnuson-Stevens Act, Pollock, even if it's landed in Washington or somewhere else, it's still taxed in Alaska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We've been joined in the audience by Representative Seaton and Representative Reinbold. Representative Guerra has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Direct marketers, those are fishermen who sell directly to a consumer in the lower 48 or to a restaurant here. That's what you mean by direct marketers?
Yes. Through the chair, Representative Guerra, yes, that's correct.
Okay. Continue, gentlemen.
Okay, the fish landing tax is levied on the unprocessed value of a fisheries resource first landed in Alaska but processed outside. The value is calculated using a statewide average price, which is developed by the Department of Fish and Game and adopted by the Department of Revenue for tax purposes. It's mainly the factory trawlers, loading processors, and again, it has a 50% municipal sharing, like the business tax. Fisheries landing tax is started in 1994. It was originally 3.3% of the unprocessed value. It's now 1% for developing species and 3% for established species. With the exception, pollock is subject to a landing tax even if it's not landed in Alaska. That is, if it's caught within the exclusive economic zone, which I think extends to 200 miles offshore of Alaska. And that's due to the 1999 American Fisheries Act.
Co-Chair Newman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Burnett. What's the difference between a developing species and an established species, and why is there a difference in tax rates, Sir Jerry?
Through the chair to Representative Newman, over the years, certain fisheries have just been starting out. People had not identified them as a fishery. The Department of Fish and Game identifies fisheries as developing fisheries, and each year reports to the Department of Revenue which ones those are, and it's just a matter of wanting to get a new fishery developed. It could be some new species or some new use of a species that wasn't caught commercially before.
Follow up, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Burnett, is there a time limit on that, or is it developed, and what does developed mean in that essence? Is it, what is it? I mean, that's a pretty broad expanse.
Mr. Brooks.
Through the chair, Representative Newman, there's criteria established in Title 16, 1605-050. We provide a letter, I think it's in the packet certainly from the Fish Committee, of all the fisheries, and they'll move from developing to established once they meet certain criteria of catch and value and things like that, and then they move to an established category.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brooks, is there a set rate or percentage of this money that's collected off of these fisheries that goes back into the Department for Commercial Fisheries Management?
Through Chair Representative Newman, all the funding that we're talking about here is unrestricted general fund. So the Division of Commercial Fisheries budget is heavily reliant on unrestricted general fund, but there's no direct correlation of revenue going back to them.
We've been joined in the audience by Representative Stutes. Next we have Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if there was a direct correlation, do we know how much the taxation, if it went to Fish and Game, does it meet how much you spend, or do we need an adjustment there?
Through the chair and Representative Wilson, the amount of tax revenue generated from developing fisheries is very small. I'd say it's a couple hundred thousand dollars out of $50 million that we're talking about here. So these developing fisheries are quite small.
A follow-up?
Representative Wilson.
So if we were to break it down in Fish and Game and the different things that Fish and Game does to support our fishing industry. Do you have some kind of document that would show whether or not we're pretty sustainable to what's being charged right now, or maybe it would show us adjustments that we might need to make so that basically whatever they're able to help their businesses is also being paid by the industry?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, there's a couple different approaches we have where the commercial fishing industry pays for management programs within the department. We have test fish activities that generate revenue. Even with developing fisheries, one of the recent ones in the past was sea cucumbers here in Southeast. And the dive, it's a dive fishery, and the dive feed assessed itself to pay for the management. So you have those kinds of things. Throughout the department that pay for the different types of activities. I don't know if to hit the mark on your question.
We'll follow up.
Representative Wilson.
So I guess I'm looking for the activities that don't, in both directions. I mean, are there times that we're paying for a certain activity and they're actually paying more than what the activity takes? And are there other activities that are pretty much to the same industry that we're not meeting?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, typically when we're billing or we enter a cooperative agreement with industry, It's the cost of that fishery. It's a dollar for dollar. There's not an extra profit. Now, in the context of the bill, I think when we when the administration came forward with a 1% increase on the tax, part of that was targeting about an $18 million revenue generation, because the current revenue rates or the current tax rates generate in the area of $50 million that is shared with municipalities. We have a ComFish budget. That's about $35 million in unrestricted general funds. There's a lot of federal funds and other types of revenue in there. So part of that was a recognition of the commercial fishing industry, I guess, paying an additional or increased tax rate to cover costs of management, some enforcement costs, things that are related to commercial fishing in the state.
Thank you.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the developing fisheries, what if they're really profitable? We're charging one-third the rate on shore-based, half the rate on floating processors. I mean, what if they're really profitable? Why are we charging? What's your calculus for the low rate if they're really profitable fisheries?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, the criteria and statute are really while they're developing. Once they hit that profitable, or they're developing us or contributing a significant portion of catch and revenue, they would move to an established category and start paying that higher rate.
Chair.
We've been joined in the audience by Representative Johnson. Representative Guerra.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't know what that means once they're contributing revenue. What is really the standard? Is it when they become really profitable, or what's the standard?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, the standard is less about the price, but it gets to, and I'll just read it here if I might. The optimum yield for the harvest of the species has not been reached. That's one criteria that would be developing. So once it meets optimum yield, it would move to establish. A substantial portion of the allowable harvest of the species has been allocated to fishing vessels of a foreign nation. I'm not quite sure what that one is, but and then a commercial harvest of the fish species has recently developed. So really it is getting into a new recently developed fishery, giving it a leg up while it gets established. Once it gets established, then it moves to that statutory category.
And Mr. Chair, if I could add, this is Jerry Burnett, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue. In the CS before you, the tax rates for the developing fisheries are exactly the same as for developed fisheries. That was changed in here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Guerra.
The state has historically had a problem with dedicated taxes, right? I mean, all the taxes that come in for a particular industry go to that industry. All the taxes that come in for a particular group of people go to that group of people. And we've said, well, taxes, we have schools, we have a lot of services in the state, and dedicated taxes don't work. But what's going on in the fishery tax is that all of the money that the state gets is going to fund the commercial fisheries division, right? I mean, you said the commercial fisheries division costs about $35 million, and the state portion of the tax is about $25 million?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, all the tax revenue generated from the existing taxes and proposed taxes go into the unrestricted general fund. for appropriation by the legislature. It's not designated or dedicated in any way. We're just trying to give you a dollar context there.
In effect, it's dedicated because we got $25 million in state fisheries taxes for a commercial fisheries department that costs us $35 million, right? I mean, so we raised 25 and the commercial fisheries division costs $35 million, right, in state funds. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, the numbers are correct. It's not a dedicated fund.
In effect, it is. Thank you.
Follow up, Representative Guerra?
No.
Next, we have Representative Kawasaki, I think. Representative Sadler.
Well, no? Thank you, to the chair. I was going to ask Mr. Brooks what some examples of developing fisheries were. You said sea cucumbers. Anything else that a landlubber might recognize?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, and these are, they might be developing one part of the state, but not in another because of the existence of a fishery. So some of the ones we have here, Atka mackerel developing in the eastern Bering Sea, arrowtooth flounder in southeast, ling cod in several areas. Ling cod is also an established fishery in many, many other areas. Pacific hake. Dusky rockfish in southeast Alaska. There's a long list, and again, I think the letter that we sent to Revenue is part of the packet.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It kind of goes along to the same question that Representative Guerra had. When it comes to oil taxes, this team or this committee is well versed in understanding how taxes are levied in other. Provinces and other jurisdictions. I have no idea if 3.3% is a good number or a bad number. And when it comes to specific species, I have no idea if we're the only place that has a certain species. Why wouldn't we have a higher percentage on that particular stock or species?
Okay. Through the chair to Representative Kawasaki, most states don't even have a fish tax for commercial fishing. Washington State is an example of one, and I was going to get to that. They have rates that vary from about 1% to a little over 5%. I think California, as I recall, has taxes that are species-specific. Alaska has chosen over the years the system we have, which is a gross tax based on the value of the fish as it's landed. There are many other ways that it could be done. This is the way it has developed here. We could have rates on a species-specific or a profit-specific basis, but it is a gross tax. The economics of each fisherman are probably different. The fish tax actually is, well, it's collected by the state at the business level, the processor level. The processors, when they buy the fish from the commercial fishermen, actually deduct the value of the tax from the fish when they sell it. So the commercial fishermen are the ones that pay it, and to try to construct a tax that would be economically specific to each one would be a very difficult proposition. I suppose it could be done, but it would be a very complex tax to pay, and it would be a very complex tax to administer. But we have just the variability between the shore-based and the floating processors and some other, and the cannery tax based on value.
Representative Kawasaki, follow up.
Yeah, just a follow up. And can you tell me just if you've got a history or sort of a background on, Alaska seems to be an international destination for fisheries. It just seems like there's a lot of foreign fleets and, of course, a lot of Washington State fleets. Can you tell me by way of, do you have any international experience in what other international provinces do when it comes to their fisheries?
To the chair, Representative Kawasaki, I don't have any of that information here.
Okay.
This time.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess first off, just to clearly establish that the purpose of House Bill 251 is to sort of create a way for the fishing industry to play its role in closing the state's fiscal gap. Is that correct?
Through the chair, to Representative Edgman, that's exactly correct. This was one of many bills that was making sure that each group and each type of business in Alaska would be paying a portion of the cost of running government in Alaska.
Follow-up, Representative Edgman.
And as a follow-up, Mr. Co-Chairman, I bring that up because the discussion, as it did in prior committees, invariably is going to sort of morph into the commercial fishing industry and whether it pays its way in Alaska and whether these dollars are directed towards narrowing the gap of general fund dollars that are used for paying for primarily the Department of Fish and Game. But I just wanted to make that distinction clear at the outset. Second question I wanted to pose is I wanted to ask a little bit about the discovery process behind coming up with these numbers. And I wanted to, maybe someday we're going to get these mics fixed. We got the same mics on the floor and we can speak 2 feet away, but here in the committee they got to be 6 inches away from you. You know, the oil industry was brought up a moment ago, and it's interesting, by contrast, we all know that the oil industry in its heyday paid 90% or so of the state's unrestricted general fund in the state treasury. The fishing industry and the mining industries we'll see tomorrow are certainly significant industries in their own right, but are a lot smaller in terms of their contributions to the state treasury. But back to the question about the discovery process, with the oil industry, we hired a third-party expert, and through the various regulatory changes and the tax regimes that we have gone through, we have had outside analysis come in and expert analysis sort of help us better understand that cost and benefit sort of picture that's tied to you know, this exploratory journey that we're on with the taxes of the fishing industry today, mining industry tomorrow. But so what did the administration do to sort of bring in that type of expertise? And I raise that question because I'm hearing around the table some very basic questions about the various sectors of the fishing industry, whether it's state waters, federal waters, southeast, Gulf, Bering Sea, Aleutian Islands, whether these are bottom fishing, salmon fishing, just a whole number of things. This picture could be very complicated if we dug into it thoroughly. And so back to the issue about cost and benefit, what did the administration do to sort of explore this in a way that would look at the benefit side but also the cost side to an industry that has its ups and downs, very much like our bellwether industry, the oil industry?
Through the chair to Representative Edgman, this is Jerry Burnett, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue. The oil industry, as you know, is a much larger percentage of our revenue, and so a lot more attention is paid on any changes there and the economic effects. This process was primarily an internal process. We have a tremendous amount of expertise within the Department of Fish and Game in particular on the various types of fisheries. We have economists within the Department of Revenue who looked at the various parts of the proposals. So this was an internal process, not an external process. And we did not, to my knowledge, use external consultants and spend the types of money that you would have spent to analyze this with external consultants.
Just a follow-up, Representative Edgman.
Yes, and thank you for that clarification. I thought it was important to get that on the record. For the record, in terms of closing the fiscal gap, I intend to be take the approach that everybody has got to help sort of bridge that gap, and no industry, no group within the state of Alaska sort of gets a pass on it, if you will, but we need to do it in a way that's certainly fair. And I'll just close by saying that it'll be a concern of mine throughout this discussion that this exploratory process that we're going through, you know, maybe is just sort of touching the veneer of it all, the very surface, in terms of the overall impact, because when you're talking commercial fishing, you're also talking seafood industry, and if you're talking seafood industry, you're talking maritime industry, and if you're talking maritime industry, you're talking the health and well-being of coastal Alaska, as well as how that interacts with the international airport in Anchorage and the transportation sector, and it really blossoms into a much larger picture, even though the fishing industry, back to the UGF and its contribution to the state's treasury, is a sliver compared to the oil industry. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Edgman. Representative Gaddis?
No.
Representative Sadler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the previous speakers putting this in context. Of course, when we bring a question of a tax increase up and assume that we're only going to raise it by a percentage or so, we're assuming that the current tax structure is the appropriate tax structure. I think that's the difficulty of bringing a tax measure before us, is we're going to ask questions, you know, and see if it's appropriate. So I'm going to ask a question just to kind of get out of the table, too. We're going to talk about mining taxes tomorrow, and there is a mining royalty. There is a royalty collected on oil and gas. Is there, either gentleman, is there a royalty the state collects on the value of the fish as the landholder of the sea holders share?
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, no, there isn't. In fact, this is a the tax which is charged is a flat tax, similar to the way a royalty is charged. So these taxes that we're discussing today really stand in the place of what a royalty would be. They're not some kind of a net tax or a tax. They're a gross tax which is constructed as a royalty would be.
One follow-up. I will make the observation that the fishing industry, as Representative from Dillingham has said, does provide the economy to coastal Alaska. The mining community, the mining industry does provide jobs and tax bases for rural economies, and I think that's some of the benefits. I hope we don't try and squeeze that golden goose too hard, but recognize everyone's got to give some. But there are benefits to the state other than sheer money to the general fund of these industries.
Okay, if we could come back to ask questions to a slide that's up, and that way we can get through the presentation, and when we get through, then we'll be opening for other questions at that time. So continue, Mr. Burnett.
Okay, so currently the way fish tax revenue is handled, 50% of it, of the growth of the tax goes to communities and boroughs, and 50% goes to the general fund and to any costs and credits that are associated with the tax. So the state actually collects a little bit less money than the local governments does under the current plan. This past year, our business tax revenue, the fish business tax revenue, the total collections were $44.4 million. The municipal share was 23.1, and the state retained 21.3. And you can go back, you can look, it varies somewhat between the years because of price of fish and amounts of fish that are caught.
As long as you're on that, can you explain the municipal shares a little bit? I mean, how is that figured? How is it divided? How is it?
Mr. Chair, my brain is failing me a little bit, but I'll let Deputy Commissioner Brooks do that.
Mr. Chairman, Kevin Brooks. So the municipal share is half of what is owed on the tax returns before credits. So take the gross revenue, half goes to the municipality. Out of the other half, the credits, the state share, the credits will be taken from that. And that's why on the table, you'll see the retained by the state is lower. And the difference between the two is credits that were provided.
But how is it divided up amongst the communities, I mean, the municipal share?
So the sharing, Mr. Chairman, Kevin Brooks again, if it's an incorporated city within an organized borough, the 50% shareable amount of the tax is divided equally between the city and the organized borough. If it's the processing or landing takes place outside of an incorporated city or organized borough, 50% of the tax collected is dispersed to communities through an allocation program that's established by the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. So there's a little different treatment between organized and unorganized.
Okay. Start as far in. Representative Guttenberg on this slide.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it says in the fiscal note, 2476 on the second page, the third paragraph down, how about this one? That the taxes are split 50-50 with the municipality in which the activity takes place. So I don't really care if I'm stepping on toes, but the resources of the state are owned by the people in common. And how far, what communities are those? I mean, if it only takes place along the coast, and you have communities upriver in various places that have been severely affected by practices along the coast. Has there been any compensation over the years that compensated for that, or do they get, is there anything for Eagle or Tanana or St. Mary's or McGrath? I mean, so...
Through the chair to Representative Guttenberg, under the current statutes, the sharing does not go outside of the areas where fish are either landed or processed or the direct communities. So, no, there wouldn't be under the fisheries tax sharing statutes.
If I may, Mr. Chair.
Representative Guttenberg.
So historically, has there been any impact compensation for those communities for fisheries, because they don't fish anymore, and it's not because they've overfished. So I'm worrying historically there's been a balance of revenue to those communities.
To the chair, to Representative Guttenberg, not aware of anything, then that would have to be something that would be an impact aid done through the legislature, which would require appropriations.
I'm just wondering if I could ask the question if we can get an answer to that from the department, or there's been any compensation for disappearing fisheries upriver, because that's traditionally where the fisher belong, and that's where they spawn, and that's where they create more fish for downriver. And I'm just trying to figure out if there's been a balance between the needs. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Cindy Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to ask Mr. Burnett, I've seen a couple of references to the state share being smaller because of credits. Could you speak for a few minutes about what credits are offered and who receives them and what their purpose is and so forth? Is that a developing fishery?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, there will be credits that go to the fisheries businesses, such as a salmon development tax, which allows the businesses to increase the value of their fish. Just a simple example would be a fish business that sells filleted fish, and they purchase pin boning machines that allow them to now sell the fish for a higher price, and it's economic development for the state that allows them to pay the commercial fishermen a higher price because they're selling the product for a higher price later on. And so it's credits of those types.
Follow up, Representative Sadler.
To forestall a series of questions, if you can give us any information back up in paper about when those first started and how effective they are, and any cost-benefit analysis.
To the chair, Representative Sadler, I'm not sure if there's anything that's been provided for earlier committees on that, but if there hasn't been, we will do that.
I'd like just to back up, and it probably isn't a very good topic to start talking about here, but. So they have a fish business tax revenue that's got municipal share. So they have revenue sharing from fish tax. They also get revenue sharing from their normal revenue sharing programs that we have in the state. Is that correct? So they...
Mr. Chair, to my knowledge, it does not change your other revenue sharing calculation when you have fish tax sharing.
Okay. We can go on to the next slide.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Brooks.
If I might, Kevin Brooks, I just want to make a plug on Department of Revenue's got a report, a real handy one on their website. It's their tax division's annual report. It has every tax in there. It has the history, the chronology, types of credits that you might see. And it was a real learning experience for me to read about this one as it related to business taxes, but it does cover all the taxes there. So just a plug for them. It's a good report.
A handy document we need to take a look at. Continue with slides.
Okay, the next slide is it's going to be the fish landing tax revenue, which, as you can see, is much smaller than the business tax, fisheries business tax. It's $8.4 million total, of which the municipal share in this case is smaller than the state share because of the way it's shared out.
Mr. Burnett, on the last slide and this one, I see quite a drop in revenues from 2014 to 2015. Mr. Brooks, is there a reason for that?
Mr. Chairman, just in the aggregate, it's price and volume. You know, it went up from 13 to 14, back down to 15. So you get some of that variability annually, but it is a reflection of price and volume.
continue.
Okay, so the next slide is our the actual proposal, which is in the bill, which for the business tax takes the tax from its current rate of 5% on floating processors to 6%, salmon canneries from 4.5 to 5%, shore-based from 3 to 4, essentially a 1% increase, except on in your current bill now, the original bill did not change the developing fisheries tax. The CS before you changes from 3% to 4% and from 1% to 4%. So the developing fisheries no longer have a different tax rate.
Representative Edgman.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Co-Chairman. And I want to be clear, I'm not, and to my seafood friends in the audience, I'm going to certainly be their ally on this discussion other times. I'm not going to be their ally because I think everybody's got to pay a little bit more, and I want to be real clear about that. But back to my earlier question about how are these numbers derived? You mentioned, Mr. Burnett, an internal process, and it's just interesting that an internal process versus a very deliberative process that we're in now can yield very different results. But just maybe give me a little more thinking about how you came up with these numbers, and then back to the emphasis earlier on cost and benefit of the interrelationship.
Through the Jerry Burnett, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue, to the Chair, to Representative Edgman, much of the discussion on this, we had a working group which included the Commissioner of Fish and Game and others, and the numbers came out of that work from there. So how those exact numbers came out, they are all even numbers, which is easier for administration and taxpaying, obviously, but there was a lot of discussion and work within the Department of Fish and Game, led by Commissioner Cotton on these numbers.
Follow up, Representative Edgman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Co-Chairman, and I suspect they'll be asked these same questions during a discussion tomorrow on the mining industry, but what kind of input did fisheries organizations or municipalities or those other industry segments that we've been talking about, what kind of input did they have into this internal discussion?
Mr. Chairman, Kevin Brooks, Deputy Commissioner, and Representative Edgman, we didn't, during those conversations last fall, we didn't talk to the fishing industry about specific tax rates. We certainly have talked to them about taxation and increased taxes, but setting the rate was not part of that discussion. And there has been, testimony in previous committees that if you go from 3 to 4%, a 1% increase is a 33% increase. If it's from 5 to 6, it's a 20% increase on that. So you do have that disparate treatment as a relative share. I think Mr. Burnett mentioned that, we didn't try to create a new tax. It was trying to do this with the least amount of administrative costs to collect. You're taking established taxes and raising them. And then there was the target of trying to get to about an $18 million number for this segment of the economy when packaged with all the other tax proposals that were put forth, and that will be on a slide that's later in the presentation.
I'll save. I've got additional questions. I'll save for this. Thank you.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just somewhat similar to Representative Edgman for a moment. I take it the cost of a crab fishery is different for the owner of for a fishing fleet than for the cost of a salmon fishery than for the cost of a pollock fishery. So the costs are different, and just out of curiosity, why are you not going to a profits-based tax? These numbers are a little bit arbitrary because they don't show the difference in costs for the various types of fisheries.
Through the chair to Representative Guerra, the reason we're not going to a profit-based tax or a cash flow based tax like the oil taxes are. There's a large number of taxpayers. They have it would be very complex, and we were trying to maintain simplicity for administration and for taxpaying purposes. Ideally, it would, you know, a tax to have the proper economic impact on each business would be some type of a profits-based tax. And then we would, you know, in a perfect world, we would know what their economic assumptions were and their, and be able to work with that. But this is a, you know, as I said earlier, it sits in lieu of a royalty. It sits as a percentage of the value of the resource, as, and that's a legitimate way when you're taxing a resource at one level.
Through the chair.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you. I understand that. I get that balance. So we want to have something that's fair to fishermen but fair to the people of the state of Alaska. Right now, basically, we lose money on the commercial fishery because we raise $23 million and it costs us $35 million to manage it. I guess let me ask you a different question. Mr. Chair, you can tell me I need to leave this for the end if you want.
We could stick to these slides. We've got a lot of slides left here. So,
all right. The question is going to be, why don't we just sort of close some of the loopholes in the corporate tax? We'd raise a lot more money.
That's true. Are we ready? Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Just for clarification, if a facility is a cold storage shore-based and also canning, do they pay both of the taxes? And would that tax be just assessed on those individual operations?
To the chair, Representative Munoz, I'll have to verify completely, but if they're purchasing the fish for the purpose of running it through their cannery business, it should be taxed at the cannery rate. If they're purchasing the fish for the purpose and selling it then as a frozen product, then it should be taxed at the appropriate rate for that.
So to clarify, there are facilities that pay both the taxes, individual facilities.
Through the chair to Representative Munoz, yes, there are. There are certainly fisheries businesses in Alaska that pay taxes under a number of different tax rates and bases here.
Representative Munoz?
But they're not paying both on one resource. They're paying separately.
Yeah, through the chair, be clear, they're not paying the taxes on the same fish more than once.
Right. Thank you.
Is that the question? All right. Okay, let's go on with the slides.
Okay, the rest of the fish tax proposal is the resource landing tax, established going from 3% to 4%, and developing going from 1 to 4 in the CS. It was 1 to 1 in our original bill. Under the new tax proposal, the fish tax revenue, prior to it being shared 50-50, the additional tax raised by the new bill, the additional 1% on, so is going to go directly to the general fund, and that's somewhere in the neighborhood of $17 to $18 million estimated this year. As you can see from prior years on earlier slides, that varies up and down. And then 50% to communities and boroughs and 50% to the general fund and credit, same as currently under the base part of the tax.
Representative Edgman on that slide.
Yes, on the slide. Has there been any analysis done? And I suspect not, but you know, as you look ahead in the next couple of years, we're not going to have much of a capital budget. A lot of my district, I'm most familiar with it, but a lot of the fishing hubs on Alaska, Bristol Bay, Barrow, King Cole, Sandpoint, Dillingham, and so forth, they're small industrial hubs located hundreds of miles from anywhere else. You've got to fly things in, you've got to barge them in. The cost of doing everything is incredibly higher. But as well, you've got additional police services, you got landfill services, you have a whole bunch of other demands on the local government. The capital budget is not going to be able to meet in coming years, presumably. So, but has there been any analysis on maybe sharing that additional 1% at the same rate with these smaller communities? Because by doing that, you're lessening the demand on the capital budget going forward, but you're also creating maybe viable local entities that are able to capture more revenue for the state and be more healthy as a result of it all.
Through the chair to Representative Edgemond, that's a good point. When we analyzed this, the point was to find additional money for the state general fund. The legislature clearly has the authority and power to appropriate money to whatever impacts the legislature chooses.
Representative Edgemond?
I'll just close because we a little bit of a twinkle in both Mr. Burnett's eyes, certainly mine as well, because we kind of know the response to all that. But I'll continue to raise that question because it's been brought to me as a concern of the local communities, and leave it for there for now.
Co-Chair Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. On that point, those local municipalities also have those jobs in those communities. They have that extra economic activity, which spurs other side activities to support businesses around them. But they also have the ability to tax locally in organized areas on those, don't they?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Newman, local governments have a variety of local taxes, and I know that some have their own local motor fuel taxes. They have their own local fish taxes. They have sales taxes and property taxes on these that may be at different values. So certainly they have the ability to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Continue on with the slides.
Okay. So the next slide is just real quick. I know it's really hard to find states that have fish taxes comparable to ours and fisheries comparable to ours. Actually, none of them have fisheries comparable to ours, but Washington has a tax which is specific to fish, and it varies from 0.09% to 5.62%. So similar ours in the range of values, but the rate depends on species in Washington.
Representative Gutenberg, on that slide.
Yes, on that slide. Thank you. Relative fish tax rate, you're talking about Washington. But is there anything else done in those communities in relation to the commercial fishing? I mean, we're just talking about a fish tax rate, but they do anything else, dock fees, you know, whatever it would be that would impact the fishing industry specifically instead of just a fish tax.
To the chair, Representative Guttenberg, are you talking about our communities or Washington's communities?
Washington okay. communities, because you're talking about their tax rate, trying to compare what they do to what we do, but do they do anything else besides just a tax on the fish that is imposed upon their fishing, commercial fishing fleets?
To the chair, to Representative Guttenberg again, I'm somewhat familiar with the state of Washington, and local governments in Washington and the state of Washington rely very heavily on sales taxes, general sales taxes, for their revenues. You'll find in Seattle maybe a tax close to 10% when you the local tax and the state tax together. They tend to tax more on a broader base than the state of Alaska does, not in industry specific, but local governments also have dock fees. The cost of keeping your boat in a marina in Washington state is probably higher than in Alaska. So
Mr. Chair, just to follow up.
Representative Guttenberg.
So you mentioned a sales tax. So is there a sales tax on the product that's sold when a fish comes into port? I mean, I know the market downtown Anchorage is famous for the Cordova fish or Copper River. Thank you. I was looking for the. Thank you. Pay something on that?
Through the chair to Representative Guttenberg in Washington, you're selling it at Pike Place Market. You're going to be paying a sales. You're going to be paying a sales tax of about 10% on that fish there, as well as the fish tax that was paid here and any other local fees and costs.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Burnett, do you know if the taxes that are paid by fish caught in Alaska or taxes that are paid in Alaska to the Alaska government, are they deductible from federal tax returns?
To the Chair, Representative Newman, generally speaking, local and state taxes are deductible from federal taxes for income tax purposes, whether it's a corporate business or an individual business type tax or an individual tax.
Fellow?
Representative Newman.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Burnett, if there was a decision by this Alaska State Legislature to increase taxes on the fisheries industry, would they be able to take that tax increase and continue to deduct that off of federal tax returns?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, I would expect that they would. There's my knowledge of the code is a little dated, but it is generally the case that you would be able to.
Thank you,
so
Mr.
there
Chair.
Would be some impact.
Just for the members, because of the way that we're hooked up with the mobile unit, they can't turn up the microphones or we get feedback. So when you speak, if you bring it up close and speak directly into it, and it would help a lot. Other questions on this slide before we move on? Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Pull it up close.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going back to the rates on species, you know, I guess it's a little bit bothers me because we have something that's unique. We've got Kodiak king crab. We have Copper River king salmon. You know, we've got Alaska halibut. People, those are household things that people really desire and want. And so I wonder if the administration has ever looked at trying to redefine rates differently on species in certain areas.
Through the chair to Representative Kawasaki, I know we've had some internal discussions about this. And as you say, you know, troll caught king salmon might have a much higher value than a, you know, just something being sold to the cannery, and maybe the economics are such that you could have a higher tax rate. We have not got to the point of being able to recommend various tax rates based on that.
Representative Kawasaki.
I don't know if 3% or 4% is better, or 1% or 2%, I just know that they're going up, and I don't know whether those relatively are good and what the impact will be for the state. And so I need to know that to be comfortable with these changes.
On this slide, Representative Guerra.
Well, on this topic, Mr. Chair. Yeah. Let me know if I have this right, Mr. Burnett. For the shore-based and salmon cannery fisheries, those tend to be sort of smaller local fishermen, smaller boats. They go to they get their fish dropped off at a cannery or a shore-based processing facility. Those tend to be smaller boats, whereas the floating processors tend to be the fishermen that have, well, much larger boats and they process on board.
Through the chair to Representative Guerra, not necessarily, because we're talking about the businesses here that are paying the taxes. You could very well have small local boats selling their fish to a floating processor, which would be paying the floating rate. The difference is perhaps, you know, you have a shore-based fishery where a shore-based plant where you have a longer season with multiple species throughout the season in that local area, and you might have a shore-based processor who comes to an area where you only have a run of sockeye salmon, or you only have a run of a pink salmon or something, and they pick those up and sell them, you know, buy them from the local commercial fishermen. So it's not necessarily the case. I think the biggest difference between shore-based and floating processors is we don't currently have a property tax on floating processors. And so there is a local property tax assessed on a shore-based processor. So I think that's where the differential came from in the early, and maybe local jobs.
And just one last question.
Representative Garrett.
And just to get a better picture of the floating processors, are some of the floating processors both processors and fishing boats as well? So it's they fish and process?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, there are catcher processors, yes. That would be the term.
Okay.
And then one of the things we've heard, if I might add on to the earlier question, was the processors now, they might do Bristol Bay in June and July for sockeye. They move down to Cook Inlet or Prince William Sound, and so they're a little bit more agile. They're going to go from fishery to fishery and process from multiple different fisheries, as Mr. Burnett had indicated.
All right, let's go back to the slides.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Munoz.
I think for the record that catcher processor has a different definition. I think the floating processor really is a business model that goes to a small, generally to a smaller community that doesn't have a shore-based facility. And a catcher processor has an entirely different meaning. And I think it's important to make that distinction.
Through the chair and Representative Munoz, we have our deputy commissioner from commercial fisheries. I could yield the chair and get the answer on the record here real quickly if you'd like.
Yeah, place yourself on the record.
For the record, Forrest Bowers, Deputy Director, Division of Commercial Fisheries. So the catcher processors are, as we mentioned earlier, are vessels that catch and process their fish on board. And floating processors are processing facilities or vessels that are operating at sea, but they're taking deliveries from catcher vessels. So one example that was brought up was Bristol Bay salmon. A lot of Bristol Bay salmon is processed on floating processors. So they're anchored offshore. They take deliveries from smaller catcher vessels. Formerly, there was a fair amount of Bering Sea crab that was processed on floating processors. Most of the catcher processors that operate now are larger vessels that participate in the trawl fisheries. And so they're processing pollock, flatfish, Atka mackerel, Pacific cod. That's where most of the catcher processor activity happens these days, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, follow-up. Co-Chair Newman.
Thank you. While we're on that point, Mr. Chair, why would a company have a floating processor instead of a processing on land? Is there tax breaks for that, or is the municipal taxes different in certain areas? Why would a company do that?
Through the chair, Representative Newman. Typically, it's to allow for more flexibility. You can move the floating processor around and allows you to participate in multiple fisheries. So that's one of the reasons that I've heard that they're used.
Well, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then is there a tax advantage to having a floating one? Do you still pay the same taxes whether you're delivering your ex vessel commodity value is to a processor that's a floating or an onshore, and the taxes to the state? I'm trying to figure out if there's a difference in the tax revenue to the state or to local communities because the fish is processed on a floating processor. And I understand the economics. It's easier to get fish. You got better fish. It's processed sooner. I get the logistics.
Through the chair, Representative Newman, if with a floating facility, you might be able to anchor up outside of a municipality or borough and avoid paying those taxes. But there is, as we've heard here, a slightly higher rate, state tax rate for those operations, Mr. Chairman.
Slightly higher tax rate. Can you give me a comparison? I don't remember what those are.
Through the chair, Representative Newman, it's 1% higher. Okay. So that's so the
4 and 5%.
Right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we've got a long way to go, Representative Guerra, on this slide.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, this is the point that I've been trying to get to finally. So the catcher processors, the trawlers, right? Correct me if I'm wrong. Those are the ones, if we're going to talk about the ones that do the most bycatch of things like king salmon, is that the trawlers?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, catcher processors are not exclusively trawlers. Many of them are. There are also trawlers, salmon trawlers in Southeast that catch and process on board. There are crab catcher processors. So they're not exclusively trawlers, but trawl catcher processors have the largest harvest of any type of catcher processor. Mr. Chairman.
I'm through the chair finally.
Representative Guerra.
Yeah. So the trawlers, A, most damage to the fishery, B, among the largest of the fishing boats out there. See, they both catch and process, so more cost efficient for them. I guess it doesn't really matter, but they're more out. It's more of an outside fleet, not an Alaskanized fleet. Why not a higher tax on these larger, more cost efficient, bigger trawlers?
Through the chair to Representative Guerra, if I could, Deputy Commissioner Burnett. Many of those trawlers are operating in waters outside of Alaska. They're within the exclusive economic zone, and we're actually only allowed to tax those fish because of specific federal laws, which it's not clear to me if changing those taxes or their differential rate would possibly have an effect on what those federal laws might end up being in the long run. But I think there's a risk there that you have to be considering when you're taxing people who are, you're only allowed to tax because of a specific federal law allowing you to tax them.
For a later discussion, Mr. Chair, thanks.
Okay, let's see if we can get through some of these slides. We got quite a bit of presentation yet, and thank you, Mr. Bowers, for coming up.
Okay, so we're really moving quickly through the rest of this, so it should be easy. The revenue impact, we're estimating of tax increases for fish in this bill would raise an additional $18 million per year, estimated based on the fall 2015 revenue forecast.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
Okay, so this is where I'm trying to understand. Okay, so we have fish as a resource to everybody, whether or not I'm the one out there catching them or eating them or what there is. So that's something that in our Constitution everybody's supposed to benefit. Then we have fish and game that's required to do certain things to make sure that we keep our fisheries healthy, that we're getting back what we need to pay for that. And then you have the whole treasury itself. So you have all these dollar amounts, now you have $18 million per year. But I don't feel like I have the basic numbers to understand what it's costing first the state, and what's necessary in fish and game for all these boats to come out. So I don't know what we're starting with. And then how do we figure out for, how much we should as a state be able to get as we're going to be looking to charging other taxes to the public, whether that's an income tax, sales tax, whatever kind of tax that we're looking at, motor fuel tax. How do I divide those two amounts up so I know where this $18 million is coming into play?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, it's a very good point. I mean, and it's one that we've talked about as well. Is it enough even for the cost to be covered? Should there be an additional contribution to the Treasury? Because, as you correctly point out, it's a common property fishery that belongs to all the people of Alaska. We've talked about this earlier slides where we have about $50 million in revenue. There's a choice that's made to do an appropriation to share that 50-50 with the municipalities. So out of the net of that, there's about 25. This 18 is adding into that is in about $43 million. The cost of fish and games, general fund budget and commercial fisheries is $35 million. But there's also other costs within government, enforcement of those fisheries in the courts for different prosecutions that might occur. There's any number of expenditures that might be tangentially related to the commercial fishing, but direct management costs in commercial fisheries are $35 million in general fund.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
So the other big issue is, and maybe this comes at the end, Mr. Chairman, but as we were talking about taking the $3,000 cap off and understanding how we are actually, in my opinion, penalizing the smaller fishermen, the Alaskans, that are here making a living, and with that cap being there, how basically the big boats, from what I understand, would be paying upwards of beyond $10,000. So how do we make...
Representative Wilson, yes. We have CFEC coming up following them to talk exclusively about the cap.
Well, perfect. Then we'll just wait until that. Well, then one question.
Go ahead.
How do you make the differential right now in the way we do it between the Alaskan fishermen and those who are not Alaskan? Is there any provision besides the size that makes that distinction? Do we give any kind of breaks to those who hire Alaskans who are Alaskan boats versus those that aren't?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, in regards to taxation, everybody is taxed. With regard to fees, which we'll talk about, that lifting that cap, we estimate would generate about $2.2 million. There is a premium that's assessed for non-residents that's derived from the Carlson case some years ago that we assess, whether it's a crew member license, a CFEC permit. Those are assessed several hundred dollars higher on a permit to fish for a non-resident versus a resident.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, continue. Oh, hold on. Co-Chair Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're not done yet. Mr. Burnett, I'm trying to contemplate the justification of a fish tax. Is it because the fisheries belong to Alaskans as a whole, as a resource? These fisheries are used, and so they pay a tax to the state? Is that the just?
Through the chair to Representative Newman, under our Constitution, as you're aware, you have to manage resources for the maximum benefit of all Alaskans, and only a few people get to catch these and benefit from them, so it would make sense either to have a royalty or a tax. I think someone else brought up the fact that we don't have a royalty, so I think there may be an obligation to charge something for this, that would be where I would go with that.
Mr. Fellow.
Representative Newman.
On that point, is the Deputy Commissioner said there may be a justification because of using Alaska resources, but currently the only tax on fisheries are on targeted species?
No, through the chair to Representative Newman, all commercially caught fish have a tax assessed to them when they're sold.
Representative Newman.
Mr. Chair, all commercially caught fisheries, so that means targeted species such as halibut, salmon, pollock, and also non-targeted species such as shark, other
through the chair
marine species that are caught.
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Newman, if they're caught and sold, there would be a tax based on their value or the actual price that they were purchased for.
And again, Mr. Chair, my point is when they're sought and they're caught and sold, but the first comment was the fact that they're taking in Alaska resources and they should probably have to pay because of that. The resource belongs to the people of the state of Alaska, but I don't see a tax on a non-targeted species such as bycatch that is caught and just dumped overboard.
Through the chair, Kevin Brooks, Deputy Commissioner. It's true there's not a specific tax on a species that's caught as bycatch.
Thank you. Let's move on with the slides. We've got quite a ways to go.
Okay, Mr. Chair, implementation cost. We're going to have to update the revenue management system. We expect a one-time implementation cost of about $100,000 and no additional administrative costs with this tax. Got a couple of slides here on how this fits into the governor's original plan to close the budget gap, and I think you've seen these many times before, so I'm not going to spend any time on them other than to show that this is the $18 million portion of that. We've got a slide here on the impacts of the fish tax proposal. I wanted to point out that it's really the commercial fishermen where the impact is. It's the businesses pay the tax, but they deduct the tax from the fish when they buy it from the commercial fishermen. And then I've got the sectional analysis, which is to your CS. I can run through that really quick. Section 1, which is the CFEC section, it removes the annual base fee for issuance or renewal of an entry permit and establishes a non-resident annual surcharge for issuance, renewal, or interim use permits. Section 2 increases the three different tax rates within the fisheries business tax by 1%, and the current rates range from 3 to 5%. Section 3 increases the tax rate within the fisheries business tax for developing fish species from 1% to 4% for shore-based facility and floating fishery businesses from 3% to 4%. Section 4 increases direct marketing value of developing commercial fish species from 1% to 4% and non-developing from 3% to 4%. Section 5 is conforming language that really is also covered in House Bill 375 that deletes the requirement for taxpayers to submit their returns to the department in Juneau. Section 6 establishes that the revenue under the fisheries business tax when the 1% tax increase is deposited in the general fund and the remaining revenue is shared. Section 7 increases the tax rate within the fisheries landing tax for developing fish species from 1% to 4%, fish species other than developing from 3% to 4%. Section 8 establishes that the fishery resource landing revenue from the 1% tax is deposited in the general fund, same as the fisheries business tax. And make sure that this is actually correct, but the Section 10 is providing effective dates for amended sections relating to the fisheries business tax and fisheries resource landing tax. And Section 11 has it taking effect immediately, and except for Section 12, the effective date is actually July 1.
Okay, on that point, Co-Chair Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Burnett, in Section 1. Section 1, lines 10 through 13, talk about an additional base fee by the Commission in a subsection, a non-resident shall pay an annual resident surcharge. Do we run afoul of any of the Carlson versus State issues with that? We're charging different rates for residents and non-residents, it looks like.
Through Chair Representative Newman, actually this is complying with the Carlson case. So we, every 3 years, OMB calculates a differential, updates it, and then we assess that to these CFEC permits as well as commercial crew member licenses. So this is complying actually with the Carlson case.
Mr. Chair, another question.
Representative Newman.
Chair, it looks like the words on page 2, lines 2 and 3, the words it talks about establishing a non-resident surcharge by regulation and removed at an amount that is close to as practical to the maximum amount by law. Why was that removed?
Through the Chair, Representative Newman, this wasn't an amendment that we put in.
I'm just wondering about the language.
I'd have to speculate, or perhaps Mr. Twomley, the chairman from CFEC, could speak to that.
And then, again, Mr. Chair, one more question. Section 7. On page 3, line 21, it talks about a person who engages or attempts to engage in a floating fishing business in the state and who owns a fishery resource. How can a person own a fisheries resource?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Newman, that's existing language. I believe that's fish once it's caught, because then it goes on to later refer to that not subject to AS 4375, but that is brought into the jurisdiction of and first landed in.
So,
Representative Newman.
So I'm assuming that, again, that's a fish that's already caught, so it's owned by the captain of that boat or the owner of that boat.
Yeah, and to the chair, if I could, this is Jerry Burnett, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue. That's under the landing tax, so that could be a fish that was caught outside of Alaska waters and brought in and landed in Alaska. So it wasn't under our jurisdiction when it was caught necessarily. So then they become the owner and bring it in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Newman.
And then also in Section 8, if we could have some better explanation or maybe a chart that talks about better about the municipal share, the 50% that goes by municipal share. I'm assuming this is how that 50% is broke out.
is described in Section 8.
To the Chair, Representative Newman, I'd be happy to provide additional information to the committee of writing, if I could.
I think that was, but I'm not quite sure. But we'll get back.
We'll make sure that my staff follows up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Gets that from him. Additional questions before we move on to FEC? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Burnett, on page 20 of the slide deck, the sectional analysis, I wanted to clarify just a few things, terminology. Section 2 increases the three different tax rates within the fisheries business tax. Can I assume for consistency between the charts that this is a fisheries business tax under established fisheries?
Through the Chair, Representative Sadler, yes, that's correct.
Continuing then on Section 4, thank you, the Chair. In the sectional analysis, Section 4 increases, are we missing the words tax rate on direct marking value, or are you actually proposing to increase the actual marking value of the fish?
Through the Chair, that was a typo, sorry. Okay, so we did this very quickly this morning after seeing the CS.
Okay, so it should read increases the tax rate on direct marking value, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay.
Just for clarity, to make sure I understand. Okay. And on page 21, through the Chair, Section 7, there's increased tax rate within the fisheries landings tax for developing fisheries species, et cetera, et cetera. And where would I find in the section analysis the fisheries landing tax for established fish species? Oh, I guess it's the fish species other than developing.
Right, other than developing.
Okay, good. Yep. Language is consistent. Thank
okay.
you.
All right, Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you. Are there any ways to avoid paying the tax?
Legally,
you mean?
Legally.
To the Chair, to Representative Pruitt, I'm not aware of any legal way that you could avoid paying the tax.
Okay, follow up.
Representative Pruitt.
So I understand that there. There are entities that have created LLCs as a way to kind of shield their payment. They end up sending it through some sort of a bonus structure.
Okay.
Can you explain that? Help me understand it.
I'll try to do this. Okay. So when Fisher to the Chair to Representative Pruitt, when fish are purchased in season, it is not unusual for a processor to pay commercial fishermen a set fee for fish. Let's say you're paying a dollar per pound for sockeye salmon, you know, and you're going through the season, and that's what you initially are paid for it when you sell it. When you then later in the season, they adjust what the actual market price should have been, and they send you the commercial fisherman a check for the other 25%. Say it's $1.25. That the actual value is. So later in the season, there's a post-season price adjustment on your fish. The issue that you raised, and so the tax is paid on that full $1.25. It's not paid on the first dollar. There have been concerns brought to us about a business or businesses where the commercial fishermen were part owners in the business. And at the beginning of the season, or when they sell their fish originally, they sell it to them for a dollar. And later on in the year, they get the 25 cents, but this 25 cents per pound is paid to them as a share of profits of the business. And the question is that business paying the tax on that full $1.25? As they're supposed to, or are they paying it on the dollar and then characterizing in their financial statements that 25 cents as a additional profit to the business have paid out? If I knew, I couldn't tell you until, you know, someone were prosecuted on that issue. We assume that people are paying taxes correctly, but you could make those payments to fishermen in that way and still pay the taxes correctly, or you could make the payments to fishermen that way and not pay the taxes correctly, which would be a violation. And if our auditors were to find something like that, that under current law, we would assess the additional tax to the company.
Dr. Pruitt.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Of course, we all know what happens when you assume, so I don't want to assume anything. How do we ensure that, I mean, obviously you mentioned auditors. Do we have auditors that are actively out there in making sure that we're getting that we're getting the appropriate value that we should based on?
Through the chair to represent Pruitt, we do have auditors assigned to the fish tax group, and in fact, because this has been a subject which has been brought up in other committees earlier this year, we have made this a priority to look at in tax returns in the future to verify that the actual, because if you recall, the taxes are paid either on the price paid on the fish or the value of the fish, and we want to make sure if the value is higher than the price paid that they're paying taxes on that value, as they should be.
Representative Pruitt.
Is there anything, I mean, this is, we're opening up fish taxes right now, just like mm-hmm. we're going to open up mining taxes. Is there something that we need to do right now to help make sure that we plug any holes? And maybe that's a scenario where we need to determine if there is a way that we don't have to find it through an audit, that it simplifies that and makes it simpler.
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I don't believe that there's anything that you need to do in the statute to deal with that, because we do have the tax returns from the other processors that are buying fish in the same marketplace. So we have ways to check the value, and it would be, it could become pretty obvious to our folks. And like I said, we did hire a new auditor and assign them specifically to, part of their task will be to look at this. There's other questions about price of values of certain fish that are caught in fisheries that are perhaps processed at sea and not sold in the round. So, you know, assessing those values, that's something that the Department of Fish and Game and the Department of Revenue work closely together, and they would, Department of Fish and Game would be able to speak better to that. But I think overall, there's nothing else that needs to be done in legislation or policy at this point.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Burnett, on page 19 of your slide deck, you make the assertion that not much of the tax burden on commercial fisheries is likely to be passed on to buyers.
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, I believe that what is intended there is to be the price is passed on to the commercial fishermen, not to the people who are buying the fish. Fish are generally sold as a commodity, and whatever the tax rate is, is going to be deducted from the price of the fish when it's first sold. And so the commercial fishermen are the ones paying that tax burden.
So through the chair, to complete my question, first is, when you say buyers, do you mean the ultimate end user who's going to be eating the fish sticks or the fillets, or do you mean the first buyer in the dock?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, both.
Both.
So that you can't really pass the price on from a tax increase in general.
And I guess here's where I'll defer to your expertise on taxes through the chair. I'm just not sure how you can make the assumption that somehow the invisible hand of capitalism will not pass on the costs to the ultimate end user and purchaser. So I'm not quite sure how you amplify that. Why do you think the end buyer will not bear the ultimate cost of tax increases?
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, except for in a few markets, you know, like the Copper River King Salmon or Trollcott Winter King Salmon or some of the halibut, there's very little power of either the commercial fisherman or the processor to sell fish beyond what the market price is. There's competition all over the world, and they're not able to increase price because of taxes. It's similar to oil, for example, that market price for oil is the same no matter what tax you pay at the beginning.
I understand. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Edgman, and then we're going to have to move on because we've got another hour at least, and that means we're probably not going to get lunch, and we're going to be probably late for the floor session. Representative Edgman.
Yes, just real quickly, on that slide, I was going to make the same point that Representative Sadler made, but to me, I would modify that that comment a little bit. Main impact is on the commercial fishing operations. Really, we don't know where the main impact is going to be because the multiplier analysis for the seafood industry in Alaska if I'm not mistaken, really is lacking in terms of the overall spread of economic value. So I would say something to effect the main impact is on the, you know, the maritime industry in Alaska or the seafood industry or something broader than that. Like the chair of the Fisheries Committee recently reminded me that you know, the seafood industry is the largest private sector employee in the state, so it's much broader than just commercial fishing operations. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Guerra, shortly.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we don't have enough information. I don't know if we're going to, I'd hope we'd be able to get some more information, but I would like to consider the factory trawler fleet. It's a highly profitable fleet. It does a lot of damage to our fisheries, and I would like to have some time to talk to people about the possibility of a separate trawler tax.
We'll be spending some more time on this bill, I'm sure. All right, Mr. Burnett, Mr. Brooks, want to thank you very much, and also Mr. Bowers for being here. And we're going to move on now to the next section. At this time, I'd like to bring Bruce Twomley, chair of the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. And also online, we have Ben Brown, also a commissioner for the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. They'll walk the committee through the portion of the bill that addresses the CFEC cap lifting. Mr. Twomley, please place yourself on the record. And Mr. Brown, are you there?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am here, and I'm going to go ahead and just let you know, I only have about 18 minutes before I have to board a flight, so if there's any specific questions the committee has for me, I'm happy to answer them preliminarily. I'm sure Mr. Twomley will be able to answer all the questions that you have, but I am here right now. I've been on for the last hour and have obviously been listening to the testimony from Mr. Burnett and Mr. Brooks as well.
Representative Wilson has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
So, the question is, I know we're looking at taking the cap off, but why would we take the cap off and not insert the current regulation so that we know exactly what people would be able to pay and it couldn't just get changed arbitrarily?
Mr. Chairman, to respond to Representative Wilson, she and her staff and I spoke about this several weeks ago when this bill was last up, or actually House Bill 249 was up before the House Finance Committee. And right now, the statute simply provides that we set fees for permits that reflect a reasonable rate of return in the fishery. In our regulation, that is interpreted into 0.4% of the average value of the permit for the 3 years prior to the year in which fees are being set, or the average of gross earnings if it's not a fishery where there are permit values. So there could be a fishery where the permits, where it's limited but the permits haven't sold, or it could be an open access fishery where there are not limited entry permits. And so, as I conveyed to Representative Wilson, Mr. Chairman, at the time, if the legislature wants to make sure that we don't abandon that 0.4% formula, then putting it in the statute would be the way to ensure that. So it's a policy call for the legislature to make, but certainly that would enshrine the 0.4% in statute, and that would require legislative action to change at any point in the future, either up or down.
And follow up?
Representative Wilson.
And if we did that in statute, would that not help take care of the concern of those fishermen who just, through regulation, it would just take a regulation change, open comment, versus a statute change in which they would have to come before us?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, you're correct. Yes, I mean, there would be a much higher bar if the 0.4% formula were inserted into the statute, and then it would be much harder for it to be changed. And so, insofar as fishermen were concerned about it being increased, I don't think any of them would be concerned about it being decreased. But if they were concerned about it being increased, they would have the assuredness that that would require legislative action.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Further questions to Mr. Brown? Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Ben, this is Kathy Munoz. I'm curious with the entry permit fee, the renewal fee, and taking away the cap, what the impact on the individual skipper is. Does the skipper pay that fee? And if so, my understanding is that every time you bring a new skipper on, the fee is reassessed. Is that true?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Munoz, our entry permits, with the exception of scallops, which we don't do vessel-based limited entry anymore, but and the hair crab, which is kind of a virtual fishery, they are all flesh and blood individual skipper-based. So on some of the larger boats that have multiple skippers that are working relief shifts, each of those individual permit holders is paying a fee for his or her individual permit. And so if someone worked 8 hours and then another skipper came on to work 8 hours, each of those two individuals would have to have a permit, and they would each be paying whatever the formula of 0.4% indicated was the appropriate fee. And that sort of brings us to the proposal at hand. Some skippers are not paying more than $3,000 because the cap was inserted in the statute 11 years ago in the 24th legislature in Senate Bill 93, sponsored by Senator Ben Stevens. At that time, the cap was $300, and it was that legislation that raised our fee system but also put the cap of $3,000 in there. So, but to get back to the main point of your question, yes, each skipper has a permit, and each skipper pays a renewal fee for that permit.
Okay. So for clarity then, if a boat has, let's say, four skippers, that fee is just assessed one time, and then it's paid individually by the skipper?
No, Mr. Chairman, Representative Munoz, that fee is assessed against each individual skipper. And so, no, if there's four skippers, each one of them will pay the fee once, and that would be a total of four times. It's not a vessel-based fee. It's an individual fisherman's permit holder-based fee.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions to Mr. Brown before he jumps on an airplane? Okay, Mr. Brown, thank you. And now, Mr. Quambley, place yourself on the record, and we're going to have some questions for you.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Bruce Quambley, Chair of the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission.
Do you want to explain the CFEC's permits and what we're doing here with this bill?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The context of this is the fees that we apply to all interim use permits and permitted entry permits. The basic formula, what's at issue here is really not interim use permits, because the permit holders who would be affected by removing the cap, none of them holds a limited entry permit in Alaska. Those are all, at least in Alaska terms, open to entry fisheries. Some of them are subject to federal limitation. So the standard we're dealing with to set the fees is 0.4% of the average catch of a permit in a particular fishery. And that's basically, those figures then are put into the fee structure, which has 40 categories of fees, and they begin with the lowest fee, $75, and now they rise to the highest fee, the 40 category, which is $3,000, but that's the cap. And so there are permit holders within that cap level who, if the formula were applied to them, they would pay higher fees, there would be a larger number of fee categories, and as mentioned, that would generate another $2.2 million in revenues.
Representative Wilson.
So on that point, though, to me it's not just about generating more capital, but at this point, our smaller fishermen, mostly our Alaskans, are actually paying more based on what they're catching than those who are in the bigger fishermen because of the cap. I mean, to me, it's the unfairness that we're talking about, not necessarily getting more revenue. Is that not correct?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson. Fishermen operating below the cap are subject to the formula, and there are a number of fishermen operating within the cap that would pay higher fees in the event that the cap were removed.
And a follow-up?
Representative Wilson.
So let's talk about those Alaskans and non-Alaskans. So how many that are above that 3,000 cap, how many of those are Alaskan boats that we're helping versus out-of-state?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we've given you two pieces of paper on that, and one of them is an analysis by Marcus Goh. Actually, it's a 2016 analysis, despite the heading. There's a typo there, but there's Marcus Goh's analysis. He provides some figures on that. The second piece of paper we've given you is a spreadsheet which identifies all of the vessels on which permit holders who would be affected by this operate, and it also identifies the home port of the vessels, and it identifies the vessel owners and the communities that the vessel owners have provided to the commission.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. On that point, do you have any idea how many of those vessels are using Alaskan-based skippers that are not necessarily based outside of Alaska with these, even though the ships may be
you know, home ported in Seattle or elsewhere, they're using skippers in Alaska.
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, I think from Marcus Goh's analysis, you can get a percentage figure. You can get a portion of that. But I don't know per vessel how that would break out.
So how, Mr. Chairman, how do we read that percentage from the information provided?
I think through the chair, Representative Munoz, Marcus Goh has given you a figure on the percentage of Alaska permit holders who would be affected versus the non-Alaska permit holders, and I can pull that out.
On the last page in the bottom of it.
Thank you. There you are.
Okay. Table 4. Everybody got that? Representative Wilson.
But Mr. Chairman, I think that does that just talk about the permits for the captains, the permits for the boats? And then how do we figure out how this $3,000 limit is impacted by these percentages?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, this applies to the captains who operate on these various vessels. And so this would be the overall percentage, the distribution between Alaska captains and non-Alaska captains. What I don't believe we have for you is we don't have an identification by vessel. We don't have a distribution by vessel to share with you.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson?
No, I'm fine. Thank you.
Further questions of Mr. Kumbley? Representative Pruitt?
So I just want to make sure I'm reading that. I don't want to make the assumptions.
Pull your mic a little closer, please. It's
foregone revenue, 88% of that is non-resident.
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, the captains in this class who are non-residents represent 88% of the total captains, and the resident captains represent 11.8%.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
So, Mr. Chairman, I don't want to sound like a broken record, but how would these documents, if not that I don't appreciate them, but how do we figure out, you know, who's benefiting the most from our resources that aren't necessarily paying, kind of back to the royalty question we had earlier, and taking it somewhere else? I mean, none of this tells us that. It tells us the captains, but it doesn't tell us the boats. It doesn't tell us, you know, are they taking the fish somewhere else and maybe not paying the same kind of fees as if they're processing here in Alaska. How are we supposed to put all these numbers together to understand that?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I mean, I believe that the picture we can present is the captains who operate within these fisheries operate on these vessels. Mm-hmm. We can also, with the help of Marcus Goh has identified the particular fisheries that are affected here in which these boats operate. And then you can also see that the specific vessels identified also have identify the permits that operate in connection with them and show the particular fisheries. And the value of the fisheries is reflected in Marcus Goh's memo, I believe, table 2.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson.
When you say foregone revenue of fee class 40 by permit fishery, what is the foregone revenue?
The overall figure is the figure, I'm sorry, through the chair, Representative Wilson, the overall figure is the figure that Marcus Goh has identified. It's $2.2 million. That's what could be collected if the fee cap were lifted.
And Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson.
Would it be fair to say that the $2.2 million we're losing are from not Alaskan boats, but most like the bigger percentage based on the other table is from non-Alaskans?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, it appears that the larger percentage is from non-Alaskan-based vessels and non-Alaskan captains.
Thank you.
Further questions? I'm sure this has probably brought more questions into your mind. If you have any others, please get a hold of my staff, Jane, and she'll follow up and get you answers. Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess for folks in the audience for the next hearing, I certainly would like the department to help us consider possibly, or maybe I'm the only one, a separate rate for factory trawlers, but I don't know if that's feasible. So
we'll follow up and ask the department to see what we can come up with on that and get you an answer if that's possible. I don't know.
Thank you.
Check it out.
Mr. Chairman, I think this fee cap issue relates to some of the factory, you know, these are all, many
yep.
of them are factory.
I understand that. Okay. Yeah.
All right. Further questions? Mr. Toomley.
Mr. Chairman, could I call two issues to the committee's attention?
Yes, you may.
The first would be that the overall effective date of this bill is immediately effective. And to change a fee for fisheries that take place in a given calendar year, January 1 would be a much more helpful effective date for this section if this is to be adopted. And the only other comment that I wanted to make was that the language that's disposed of here in Section 1 from our existing statute, that's language that was adopted following the Carlson case. And we found it to be a useful direction to the commission, and we could not understand exactly why that was being dispensed with. So those two issues I wanted to bring to your attention.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To that point, Mr. Twomley, you said you thought the effective date should be January 1st of 2016, correct?
No. I'm sorry, prospectively, the next year is what we would need.
And if you would amplify through the chair, amplify why that's important.
We're in the middle of the fishery season right now,
yeah,
I assume.
Yeah, the permits are sold on a calendar year basis. So those permits would be effective to use beginning January 1 of the year that they cover. And so if there were an immediate effective date, we'd be caught in mid-season, and I'm not sure what kind of adjustment we'd have to do. It would be difficult.
Thank you.
All right. Seeing no further questions, I'm going to set aside House Bill 251 at this time. Thank you, Mr. Twombly, very much for being here.
And thank
we'll
you, Mr. Chairman.
We'll be sending you some more questions. At our next House Finance Committee meeting, which will be tomorrow at 10:30, we'll introduce and hear an overview from the Department of Revenue on House Bill 253, which is electronic tax return, mining license tax, and fees. And with that, I recess this meeting to the call of the chair.